Every year, an enormous migration takes place in Western Europe. Millions of moths fly for days, riding wind currents towards the south in the fall and then the north in the spring. Scientists thought these insects were simply blown to their destinations. Now they've discovered something remarkable. The moths actually select the fastest wind currents and even change course to shorten their trip. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports.
Picture a massive cloud of moths flying in the darkness. They apparently know south from north by some internal compass tuned to the Earth's magnetic field, or perhaps to the position of the sun, and they can detect when the wind is blowing the way they want to go. But radar images of these migrations show that the moths aren't just blowing in the wind. Here's entomologist Jason Chapman.
The moths select the altitudes where the winds are fastest. We don't know exactly how they do this. We believe that they can sense some cue related to the wind, like the strength of turbulence.
Turbulence, you see, is an indication of wind speed. Less turbulence means faster wind. That's what the moths want, a fast tailwind, really fast.
The maximum speeds we found were approaching, approximately 100 kilometers an hour. So you can go incredibly fast.
That's millions of moths flying at about 60 miles an hour.
The speeds at which the moths are regularly traveling is often faster than the birds' travel speed.
Speed is important because wind is fickle. When it's going your way and you're a moth, you've got to get when the getting's good. Chapman, who works at an agricultural institute in Great Britain called Rothamsted Research, says the radar tracking revealed something else. The moths are like windsurfers. When the wind shifts, they adjust.
As it starts swinging around, they will start trying to correct. And we find that on average, the moths can correct for about 20 degrees of drift.
If the wind shifts too much, say 90 degrees from where the moths want to go, they simply stop and wait for the wind to change. Chapman and his colleagues tracked these migrations for 10 years and published their results in the journal Science. They even ran a computer simulation that compared how dust particles and moths behaved under the same wind conditions. The moths and one species of butterfly clearly shifted their flight paths and speed with the wind. Chapman says nightly moth migrations are everywhere. Bats know all about them. Chapman cites reports of bats in the American Southwest suddenly swarming half a mile up into the sky.
Well, the reason they're going up there is a huge migration of moths coming in and out of Mexico into the southern states, and the bats were taking advantage of this. So, there's kind of a whole ecosystem based on this, huge flow of insects through the atmosphere.
Insects that don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Researchers in San Diego say blue whales are singing a new song. They don't know why it's happening, but scientists report that blue whales are now singing a half octave lower than they did in the 1960s. From member station KPBS, Tom Fudge reports.
Here on the coast of San Diego, it's not unheard of to see a spouting blue whale. The eastern Pacific is one of a handful of areas where blue whales migrate and feed. Just a couple blocks from here is the office of John Hildebrand. He's a professor at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, and he studies the sounds of dolphins and whales.
So that's the pulse part. I went into my iTunes, but...
That pulsing sound was one of the songs a male blue whale sings to warn away other males and to attract females. But Hildebrand says their song has been changing.
They've been shifting the frequency, they've been shifting the pitch of the song to be lower each year. And that shift in pitch has resulted in a song that's now about 30% lower than it was in the 1960s.
Hildebrand says this change in register is happening in blue whale colonies all over the world, and he believes the change is tied to the elimination of blue whale hunting. Before hunting was banned in 1966, the numbers of blue whales were dangerously low.
Worldwide, in the early 60s, there probably would have been a few thousand.
Those low numbers meant there were few females available to hear a male's come hither song. Hildebrand says for males in that situation,
there's a push to have the sound go to higher frequency so that more of the girls can hear it.
In other words, the guys had to shout to be heard. But now that blue whales are more numerous, Hildebrand thinks the males have gone back to singing bass because it makes them sound bigger and more attractive to females. He says males of many species use lower tones to attract mates.
In fact, human females, if you put some headphones on and play a bunch of male voices and you say, I want you to pick out the sexy voice, Did they pick the weak little voice or do they pick the big booming voice? Right? I mean, you know the answer.
No one disputes the finding that Blue Whale Song has gone down in pitch, but Hildebrand's theory of why it's happening has raised some eyebrows.
It's a great anthropomorphism.
Richard Ellis is a whale expert at New York's Natural History Museum.
I really don't think that whales, for all their big brains and everything else, I really don't think that whales think about this.
Still, if a lower tone becomes an advantage to some males, Hildebrand says it will be copied by others. His article is published in the journal Endangered Species Research. For NPR News, I'm Tom Fudge in San Diego.
This is NPR News.
Hello, I'm Julia Child. I'm in my own kitchen today, and I'm boiling up some primordial soup.
Primordial soup.
We're doing a recipe for the chemical building blocks of life.
Well, it looks like that recipe might be changing. At least, that's what Nick Lane would like to see. He's a biochemist at University College London, and he's one of the authors of a new essay that argues life did not begin in a primordial soup of organic molecules. Nick Lane joins us from London. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
The primordial soup theory has been around since 1929. Can you remind us what it says?
Well, it goes back to people like J.B.S. Haldane, who was one of the great biologists of the 20th century, and he proposed that the Earth's early atmosphere was composed of simple gases like methane and ammonia, and they would react together under the influence of ultraviolet rays or lightning and so on to produce a thin soup, which became thicker over time, of organic molecules right up to simple amino acids. But as time went by, it began to look as if there really weren't these gases in the primordial atmosphere of the Earth. There wasn't any methane, or not very much, or ammonia, and so on.
So tell us where you think life actually began.
Well, we're placing it in a particular kind of deep sea hydrothermal vent, and we're not thinking of the famous vents belching black smoke out. We're thinking of something called alkaline vents, and they effectively percolate warm fluids up through the ocean floor, and when they react with the ocean waters, it precipitates out effectively into cells, into tiny cells, and it's these cells that we think are the setting for the origin of life. This goes back, in fact, to a guy called Mike Russell, who's been pioneering these ideas for some time, but it's really the energy in this setting that we have been interested in this paper.
So for a long time, people sort of assumed that there was some kind of electrical charge that created this phenomenon. You're now saying that this may have taken place all underwater.
Yeah, I mean, there may well have been electric charges, and it may well have produced a dilute organic soup. Our point is that once you have a dilute organic soup, nothing else happens. There's nothing else to drive it. And just simply, you know, electrocuting a corpse is no good. It's not going to bring it back to life. And an electrocuting an organic soup is not going to bring it to life either. What we've been looking for is some kind of equivalent to what goes on in modern biochemistry, the way that cells actually generate energy and the way that cells generate organic molecules today. And if you try and look at the principles that underlie it, rather than all the complex details that we know about, you find that it's a very, very good fit with the kind of chemistry going on in these vents. It's simply about the gradients across these membranes in these inorganic primitive cells, which can have powered life and which, in fact, still powers life today in us and in bacteria and every form of life that we know about.
Well, what's an example of something that we might be more familiar with to help us get a sense of how this takes place?
Well, for example, if you imagine a reservoir behind a dam of water, the way in which the water flows through power turbines and so on, and it's the flow of water downhill through the power turbine, which is generating electricity and so on. Much the same thing happens in our cells, except instead of having water across a dam, what you actually have in cells is protons. These are hydrogen ions. And you have a difference in the concentration between one side and the other side of a membrane. And it's the driving force of these flowing through tiny protein turbines in the membrane which drives energy production in all cells today. And this is exactly the setting that we have in mind with these alkaline hydrothermal vents. You have an exactly analogous proton gradient across the membrane.
So effectively, these cells might have copied the structures at these vents?
We think that the first cells could not have left these vents unless they had found a way of tapping into these gradients that were naturally existing there, and then later on learning to generate their own.
So is your hope that laboratory scientists will now try to test your ideas, the, sort of the way they did with the primordial soup theory?
Absolutely. There's a lot of gaps here. This is really an attempt to paint a larger picture and to try and focus attention on the possibility that this is the answer. But to prove that it's the answer requires quite a lot of experimental work.
That's Nick Lane. He's a biochemist and writer based at University College London. His team's paper appears in the journal BioEssays. Nick Lane, thank you so much.
Thank you.
If Toyota is looking for some kind words today, Santa Monica, California is the place to start. Lots of people there who can afford to drive just about anything have chosen Toyota's little hybrid. In fact, Santa Monica is the number one city in the country for Prius sales. And as NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates reports, today's recall has yet to rattle the true believers.
Santa Monica made a point of being green when other cities were just starting to think about it. There's even a taxi company here that runs nothing but hybrids, most of them Toyotas.
We have 14 Priuses, 3 Camrys, which are hybrids, and we have 2 flex fuel vans that are also run on alternative fuels.
Fuad Sana is the general manager of Metro Taxi. He says people actually call because of the cars.
They said, you know what, when we saw you going on the street with the idea of Think Green, we just wrote your number down. We used to call another company, but now we love your cars and, you know, the design and the green idea.
Toyota's recent problems have done nothing to change his mind. It's a common thread in what you hear on the streets of the city that put Prius on the map. Daniel Brondy, a retired French professor, stopped on Montana Avenue, a chic shopping district in Santa Monica, to enthuse about his Prius.
I love everything. I like the car, I like the line, I like the way it drives. I like all the high-tech that I don't understand, but I love to use it. I'm still learning.
His friend Rick Schenk agrees.
I love the Prius. I can't think of another car that can get that kind of gas mileage. I drive a lot, so that's been a great option.
That mindset has made California the most Prius-studded state in the nation, which is not a surprise to Carl Brower, editor-in-chief at the car research site Edmunds.com. He sees that firsthand when he drives the Pacific Coast Highway.
I have a pretty long commute up and down PCH every day, and I've come to call it Prius Coast Highway. There are lots of Priuses in the area, to be sure.
Even so, Brower says, some of the glow of satisfaction has faded for some Toyota owners in recent days. And today's Prius recall may separate the environmentally devoted from the gas conscious.
This is going to be a real test of the loyalty, because I think most people who bought the Priuses, certainly early on, were so enamored with the philosophy of the car, it would have been impossible for it to have any impact. Nothing could have really impacted their appreciation for the design and the engineering that Toyota put into the car, which is impressive.
Toyota's lag time in admitting the problem might hurt, Brower says. And now that other companies are producing gas-efficient models, including hybrids, Brower believes people who bought Priuses solely for the better mileage might go elsewhere.
So there might be a more risk for Toyota, maybe is the better way to say it, that those buyers would consider other options if they start to feel there's any kind of question about the Prius's long-term dependability or reliability or, in this case, a safety issue that has been raised.
Daniel Brondy says he's driven Toyotas for decades, and if his is one of the Priuses that's recalled, he'll get it fixed. No big deal.
My God, for years and years they have been fabulous. It's a little mistake, that's all.
No doubt Toyota's hoping that's the typical response to today's Prius recall news. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.